Call the House Committee on Judiciary to order. Today is April 8th, 2013. First item on the agenda is House Bill 2384. And call Representative Thatcher and Barnhart, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2384 allows seizure of a motor vehicle where a person is being cited or arrested for violation driving while suspended, misdemeanor or felony driving while suspended, or aggravated driving while suspended, which adds serious physical injury and death causation to DWS, and has been cited or arrested for one of the same in the preceding 3 years, makes a second conviction of DWS violation a C misdemeanor. And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there is a dash two amendment on this bill that the various partners have worked out where you would only be able to lose your car once you had been convicted of a misdemeanor, and it also has a sunset.
Okay, thank you.
Why did you lose your car once, you said?
Is that what it says?
No. Okay. Please go ahead. And if you would try to remember, we have a couple bills today that are going to be pretty lengthy, so if we could...
We'll try to keep this one short if
Thank
we can.
You.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'm Phil Barnhart, State Representative from House District 11. I want to let you know that this bill came up as a result of a constituent concern, a constituent who was rear-ended by a person driving with a suspended license and who therefore was not insured. Our constituent sustained injuries, medical expenses that her insurance company had to cover and had no real ability to recover against the driver that hit her because he was uninsured as a result of driving while suspended. The bill deals with the issue in a way that provides an extra tool to get drivers off the road who are driving while suspended and who do it kind of habitually. It adds an ability for law enforcement agencies, if they want to use criminal forfeiture statutes, also allows for the use of civil forfeiture statutes in jurisdictions where that works for them. We have some amendments that we think will actually make the bill better, easier to administer. The most important thing I want to point out is that there have been a lot of questions about this bill that have arisen in the process of discussing it. And the main thing for the committee to remember is that the issue around forfeiture was fully hashed out and fully vetted when the constitutional amendments that we have voted on twice came up. The statutes have fully covered the kinds of issues that people have raised, and we're not reopening these forfeiture laws at all. All we're doing is adding a situation or a couple of situations in which the forfeiture can be used in addition to the ones that were already there. But protections for owners who are not driving the car exist in the current forfeiture laws. We're not changing any of those. And I think it should be obvious as you think about it that those forfeiture laws that we have now would never have been passed if innocent owners could be in have a problem as a result of a forfeiture action. One of the important changes, I think, is that there's been a proposal that instead of having the second driving while suspended charge being the operative one that leads to a potential forfeiture or seizure, that instead it essentially is the third one. I think that's raised as an issue that helps protect some individuals who are concerned about that issue. And I'm going to leave the technical details to others and stop there, if I could.
Thank you, Representative. I appreciate that. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, members of the committee. Thank you for listening to us today. I'm Representative Kim Thatcher from Kaiser, representing St. Paul and Newburgh as well. And I have a constituent here with me as well. He's at the other end. He's a law enforcement officer, and he gets, and I've heard from others too, they're very frustrated. They can't do more about the issue, about this issue than give him a traffic ticket and watch him drive off once again without, with a suspended license. I've pulled together a few numbers just to give you a general idea of how big the problem is here in Oregon. And last year, there were 185,000 people who had driver's licenses suspended or revoked at some point in the year. And that comes to about 6% of the population we're talking about as far as people who have been issued an ODL. Don't know how many people this would impact exactly, but According to ODOT, they did a one-day snapshot last year, and there were more than 32,000 drivers who had more than one conviction of driving while suspended in the past 3 years. And over 8,000 of them had at least two convictions over the last three. So without going into great detail, it's interesting to look at some of the reasons that people are suspended, and that accounts for most of them. And this would be too many traffic tickets or crashes, and also those related to DUII. Some are related to people who haven't paid their court fees for traffic cases. There's lack of insurance, failure to appear, or something tied to an accident. So last fall, I got an email from Sergeant Bill Gill, lives in my district, and he will share with you some of his issues. But he said, I just want to quote this one part. He says, current law means that as citizens, we are subject to being victimized by the drivers who have no lawful driving privileges or who are driving uninsured, and the police are impotent to even remove the vehicles from the roadway. And that is who I worry about, those who have been victims and might become victims of these people who shouldn't be behind the wheel. So after some research, learned that Representative Barnhart also been working on this problem, and he graciously agreed for us to join forces on this effort. And I thank you for listening.
Thank you. Sergeant, go ahead. Thank you. Chair Representative Barker, members of the House Judiciary Committee of the great state of Oregon, I thank you for the opportunity to come and speak before you today. My name is Sergeant William W. Gill. I work for the City of Hubbard Police Department, and I live in the city of Kaiser, 3628 Rivercrest Drive. The letter that I wrote to Representative Thatcher was over my concerns that there's a segment of the population who I consider to be either serial offenders or repeat DWS offenders. We have two statutes that deal with DWS offenders. One's at the criminal level for people who commit crimes while driving a vehicle. And I feel pretty effective in dealing with those issues to get those people off the road and to prevent them from immediately driving away in that vehicle and creating a risk to the public. But in terms of the driving while suspended infraction, typically those are due to violations or administrative decisions by DMV. And people that have no fear of being suspended or have no fear of financial obligations, they just flaunt the law because they can become more suspended or they can owe more money. But if they're not bothered by that, they just continue to drive. And they literally laugh in the face of law enforcement. I spoke to a deputy with Marion County who encountered a 40-time DWS offender, and he laughed and said, "What's the point?" And because the car wasn't a hazard where it was stopped at the traffic stop, and due to some current case law and civil concerns that agencies have, there was a licensed driver in the car, and he had to let that person drive away in the vehicle. And my greatest fear individually is that I will write somebody a traffic ticket for driving while suspended. And I'm talking specifically about people who have 77 DWS suspensions, 57 DWS suspensions, 34 DWS suspensions. These are all Marion County residents. These are people that subject all of us and our families at risk. And that I will cite one of these individuals and find out later that they were involved in a fatal crash or a serious injury crash to somebody because I wasn't even able to tow the vehicle on the stop. And this is the reason why I come before you today. I spoke to members of other police agencies within Marion County, their traffic teams. Everybody has shared the same concerns that I have. Unfortunately, many couldn't be here today to speak and show their support, but it's there, it's out there. And we all share the same concern. I know that there's been some opposition to the statute. There's some interest groups that feel that they have a stake in this. And my only concern would be that I think that we need a solution that attaches to everybody, regardless of who we are, where we are, what business we're in. And I'll leave that for people that have more expertise in that arena than myself. Hopefully I've shared enough with you today to you know, quickly explain my frustrations and my concerns and hopefully encourage your support for House Bill 2384. Okay, I think it's important.
I'd like to ask you, I don't know if you know the answer, but it seems to me, I mean, I can remember in days gone by where somebody was suspended like a teenager and the insurance company would say, "We're going to cancel the insurance because we don't trust it. He won't be driving one of the cars. He's not insured." So could we pretty much assume that people who are suspended like this do not have insurance or not able to get it?
Chair Barker, that is pretty accurate. Most insurance companies will not insure drivers who are suspended. I mean, that's just a given. But so often, other family members, friends, they'll register these vehicles in other names, but you are absolutely true. Quite often, and more often than not in my experience, the person who is DWS is also driving uninsured.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, yes.
Thank you. So, Sergeant Gill, so when you had that list of suspensions, are you saying that was one person that helped that?
This is one person, and highlighted here is suspensions, a total of 77 in their driving history they have 77 suspensions on
one person.
One person
had 77 suspensions.
Yes, Representative Tony, that's true.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, panel. Dana Vitolins, Carl Myers, and Daryl Fuller, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Dinah Vitolins, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association today, and I'm the Crook County District Attorney. We're here in support of House Bill 2384 and the Dash 2 amendments with one requested change. In the Dash 2 amendments, the basis for criminal forfeiture is limited to Class C misdemeanors, and we'd like that expanded to A or C misdemeanors. So essentially, if you've committed the crime of driving while suspended, we'd like the criminal forfeiture statute to be able to be used. House Bill 2384 gives law enforcement an extra tool to get driving while suspended individuals off the road. The key points to this bill is that you must have been convicted of the crime of driving while suspended before you would even be subject to forfeiture. So my example is Mr. William Babcock Jr. in Crook County has been arrested and convicted six times in the last 18 months of driving while suspended as an A misdemeanor. And he continues to do that because we don't have jail space. He doesn't care about probation. We simply charge him. Yet he has a vehicle he owns. This would give me a tool to get him off the street at least for a while. The concerns about innocent owners or claimants have been raised. And I'd like to say that both the Oregon Constitution and the civil and criminal forfeiture statutes protect innocent owners or claimants. So essentially, if it's a rental company, if it's Aunt Minnie, if it's a bank, essentially it's the burden is on the government to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that that individual acquiesced in the prohibited conduct or took the asset with the intent to defeat the forfeiting agency's interest. And that's impossible to prove in the context of a rental car company that's a legitimate business or somebody who truly doesn't know. I loaned my car to a friend. I had no idea my friend's license was suspended. So with that, I'd request that you support House Bill 2384.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Carl Myers on behalf of the Oregon Municipal Judges Association, the Oregon Justice of the Peace Association. While we support the proponent's desire to get rid of the particularly the serial driving while suspended people, and we see them in our courts all the time, we have concerns about the bill. Neither association has taken a position for or against, but we think that this discussion has come up a number of times, and you need to be aware of some of the repercussions if you pass 2384. If you pass 2380, and I'm not addressing the civil forfeiture aspects of this, we have no quarrel with that. There are issues, constitutional issues, with the civil forfeiture and criminal forfeiture, but we're most concerned about the enhancement of second and subsequent convictions of DWS. If you know at all anything at all about the DUII laws, you know that for a first DUII offender, While it is a violation through the diversion program, you still have to offer that person a right to counsel because of the subsequent convictions will be treated as crimes. That's what will happen here with DWS. Many of the local courts, and my court in Kaiser handles 10 or so DWSs a week, but many of the local courts are not set up to handle appointment of counsel, jury trials. As a matter of fact, the city of Kaiser is not allowed to handle any criminal matters through its charter. But many of them are not set up to handle that, and that will force DWS's, even the first violation, to go to the circuit court and be handled by the district attorney and to pile on cases at the circuit court level. You need to also understand that many DWSs arise from non-driving kinds of situations, failing to pay child support. It is extremely difficult in the West, particularly, and I have found it particularly difficult in this part of the Valley, to offer an alternative to somebody with a driving while suspended license who needs to get to and from work. The infrastructure, the buses, public transportation, is just not sufficient in many cases to get there. So they're they have a Hobson's choice: either drive to and from work to pay off child support or their fines that are causing them problems, or run the risk of getting pulled over for driving while suspended or not driving at all and never being able to pay those fines off. So it is a very difficult situation. The judges have dealt with this have been concerned about this for many years, and we've been trying to come up with a solution. Quite honestly, we can't. But you need to be aware that this will have a significant impact, not only on local court revenues, but on expenditures at the circuit court level as those cases get pulled over. I want to offer you. There is one alternative that currently exists for handling repeat offenders of DWS. That is, take away their license. The next time they get pulled over, have the police cite them for failing to carry and present a license, which is a misdemeanor. We talked about instituting that in Kaiser because of the problems that we had, but I talked to the Marion County District Attorney, and he said, we won't prosecute failing to carry and present. It's just not high enough on our list. So, in fact, if we went that way, there would be no penalty in any event. Some jurisdictions do that. Last time I heard, the city of Dallas was taking away their license, and then the next time a person came in, they were citing for failing to carry and present. But that that alternative exists now. But with meager resources at all levels, including the local court levels, the enhancement or criminalizing a DWS just doesn't make sense. I'll be happy to answer any other questions.
You think any questions? Thank you, brought up some interesting points.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, here in support of House Bill 2384. As the district attorney testified previously, our concern is there are circumstances where we have serial drivers and we don't have an appropriate remedy because we just don't have room in our jails for them. They're put in the process and out of the process so quickly that it simply becomes a penalty-less crime if we cannot find a way to discourage these people from driving. And so we support this bill as an opportunity to provide perhaps a kind of penalty that they will understand and that may prevent them from driving as much as they are now. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, panel. Jim Gardner, is he in here? Dave Reinhardt.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I'm appearing today for Hertz. We have no problem whatsoever with the substance of the bill. We think it's, in fact, a good step forward for the reasons that the other witnesses have mentioned. We also appreciate the assurances that have been offered by Legislative Council and by the District Attorneys Association witness to the effect that it would be impossible to prove a circumstance with respect to a rental car company that would result in the seizure and forfeiture of a rental car vehicle owned by Hertz or one of our competitors. This is a kind of a situation, though, that is what I would analogize to trust but verify. We think it is important to have an explicit, codified, and speedy off-ramp, if you will, to the seizure and forfeiture process so that we're not stuck in a situation where we're, in fact, forced to litigate a forfeiture action that would probably result in our victory 99.9% of the time. So what I have asked you to consider, and this amendment was turned into LC this morning, is a very short, simple provision that basically treats rental car companies in the same manner that the Oregon Constitution treats financial institutions. And it basically, that provision basically says that if we can demonstrate that we are the owner of the vehicle in question, it is not subject to forfeiture or seizure. Now, it's my understanding that the proponents disfavor this amendment. That's a little puzzling to me, since it seems to comport with their assurances that we would not, in under any circumstances, be subject to forfeiture. And for that reason, I would urge even more strongly that it be given favorable consideration.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Dave Reinhart, representing Enterprise Rental Car. I fully expected to be here this afternoon supporting this legislation. Worked with Representative Barnhart, Representative Thatcher, and her staff, as well as Legislative Council. But I am forced really to oppose this at this time, given Enterprise's considerations. Jim Gardner and Enterprise are more belts and suspenders. I'm generally just a suspenders guy, but not in this case. And maybe something can be worked out. We'd be happy to continue our discussions.
Okay. So, and Mr. Gardner, just let me be sure I understand. So the bill that you propose puts you in the same categories of banks. So
the banks have that protection under the Oregon Constitution, that if you can show ownership in the property, the case is over. It would treat us in exactly that, with parity to that situation.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions from anybody? Thank you very much.
So, Mr. Chairman, okay. I just got a letter from Heidi Elliott talking about what implications this would have on car rental companies. I don't know if you'd like me to read it.
Go ahead, please.
All right. So it's addressed to Representative Barnhart, and it reads, you asked what impact, if any, passage of House Bill 2384 would have regarding the interests of rental car companies, employers, and financial institutions. The answer is those entities are protected under the Oregon Constitution and the procedures set out in ORS Chapter 131A. Under Article 15, Section 10, Sub 3 of the Oregon Constitution, forfeitures are prohibited without a conviction unless the person consents to the forfeiture, acquiesced in the criminal conduct, knew or should have known that the property constituted an instrumentality of the crime, or took the property with intent to defeat forfeiture of the property. Unless the vehicle falls in within one of the narrow exceptions, a judgment of forfeiture may not be entered until and unless the person claiming the property is convicted of a crime in Oregon or another jurisdiction. Thus, assuming a rental car company or employer or any other owner of the vehicle who is not subject to forfeiture has not consented to the forfeiture, failed to respond, or somehow acquiesced in the criminal conduct, the vehicle could not be forfeited. As for a financial institution, Article 15, Section 10, Sub 8 states that if a financial institution demonstrates an interest in the property, then that interest is not subject to forfeiture.
Mr. Chairman, may I respond briefly? That is all correct. However, the crucial difference is that financial institutions are not required to essentially go through the forfeiture litigation process as soon as they demonstrate an interest in the property, case is over. And that's what we want to avoid. We want to avoid being caught in a situation where we have to spend money litigating what will undoubtedly be a successful case, but we and get the car back so we can start renting it again.
Okay, thank you very much. Aaron Jeffers and Gail Meyer. Becky Strauss as well. I'm sorry. I said Gail Meyer. Go ahead.
Sure, I'll go ahead. Chair Barker, members of the committee, Becky Strauss here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. We are here in opposition to the bill, and I just want to, in addition to some of the many concerns that have been raised by prior witnesses, just want to add a couple to the pile of concern. I think in regard to the Dash 2, I do want to emphasize on the record my understanding is that the Dash 2 is meant to address the issue where someone, it seems a little unclear in the Dash 2, but I think the intent is to say that civil forfeiture could not occur without an arrest. Of course, that would be complying with the Constitution. But the way that the initial bill was drafted, it appeared to be unconstitutional in that way, and just want to reiterate on the record that I think the intention of the Dash 2 is to say that change Section 2 to say a motor vehicle may be seized for forfeiture so that the vehicle could be seized on arrest, but the forfeiture process could not complete under the civil forfeiture statutes without a conviction. So just want to be clear and make sure that that is the case. I will raise what has been addressed as well about kind of the collateral consequences of a civil forfeiture process on someone's vehicle when oftentimes the people violating, committing the crime, if you will, or the violation, depending on which number of offense, are not driving their own car. And so the impact that may have on other people is worth noting. I know that there are some constitutional protections for that. And I think the probably the piece that is least deferential in the Oregon Constitution to the family member would be the standard that the claimant knew or should have known that the property constituted proceeds or an instrumentality of the criminal conduct. And I think part of this is just to say that in a civil forfeiture process, the claim is against the property. And so I think it may be more appropriate to stick with the criminal forfeiture route. If the property is not the property of the person who's committing the driving violations, I think we've all said here today that it's not the intention to be seizing someone else's property when they're not involved in the conduct. And so I guess I'm still unclear as to why we need to go the civil forfeiture route. And then I just want to raise another piece kind of around the practicality of what would happen here. In order to make sure that this all works within the context of our Constitution, the underlying bill in the Dash 2 keeps this change, as we all know, elevates the second or subsequent violation of the DWS to a Class C misdemeanor. I just want to raise the issue that it seems like it would be expensive to prosecute at the C misdemeanor level, and so I wouldn't be surprised to see the C misdemeanor charges be dropped down to violations in routine practice anyway, which takes us out of the civil forfeiture, criminal forfeiture ability anyway. So I question how far we're getting with the bill. And I'll stop there and let Aaron give the details. Thanks.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Aaron Jeffers for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. So we have two main concerns with the bill. One is pre-conviction seizure, not the forfeiture, but just the seizure alone and the collateral consequences that would bring. And then also would be the difficulty of the defendant or the family litigating the forfeiture itself if it proceeds to that process. So we're concerned there will be a disproportionate impact on poor families, families with only one vehicle. If this is the vehicle that's seized and held, then kids may not be able to get to preschool. People, the wives or husbands and wives may not be able to get to work, or fathers and mothers. So we're concerned about the disproportionate impact it will have in that situation. Fighting against the forfeiture
itself requires litigation, especially if you're the owner and not the person that is charged with this violation or conviction. So there is a way for you to file a motion and argue that it is not yours, but I don't know. I know there is a notice requirement, and I know that that counsel would have to be appointed for the C misdemeanor cases, but we're not sure if the right to an attorney would apply to the forfeiture proceeding itself, either for the defendant or for the actual owner of the vehicle if it's not the defendant. One other concern is that the criminal forfeiture appears to be able to occur after the second conviction and not the third, based on the drafting of how it appears in the criminal code. It just says on the second conviction. And so it's been stated that the purpose is for this to happen on the third conviction. And so we would think that the criminal portion, if that's the case, to be consistent, would have to be amended to where it's the third and not the second conviction on which this can begin. And even though there are protections for people that are the owners, there's no requirement in this that the owner of the car be the person violating the law. So again, it can be seized when the owner is not the violator. It can be forfeited if they're not successful or fail to appear to any of the proceedings where the forfeiture is going through, or if they just lack the resources to contest the seizure. Finally, I'd like to state that the purpose behind this bill seems to be people with, according to the testimony, really lengthy history of driving while suspended and just flaunting the system, so habitual offenders. But the bill itself is in no way limited to habitual offenders. It's far broader than that, and thus the consequences are also far broader than the intended goal of this bill.
Any questions? Thank you. We are not ready to work the bill today, so we will carry it to 4:15 for our work session. Close the public hearing. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3284. I'm sorry.
3184.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yes, 3284.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3284 eliminates the statute of limitations for certain crimes committed against minors. Crimes are rape 1, sodomy 1, unlawful sexual penetration in the first degree, sex abuse 1, incest. Lengthens statutory time of prosecution for strangulation, criminal mistreatment 1, rape 2 and 3, sodomy 2 and 3, unlawful sexual penetration 2, sexual abuse 2, using a child in display of sexual conduct, encouraging child sex abuse in the first degree, promoting prostitution, compelling prostitution, and luring a minor. Act declares an emergency effective upon passage.
Okay. Call Carla Benson, Dr. Curry Hickox, and Eric Hassel.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just while they're coming up, as you can look out and see a good chunk of the room having those stickers, yes, on 3284. I just want to acknowledge probably about twice as many are in the overflow room here, even though just because you aren't in there or in here doesn't mean we don't know you're there, and we appreciate your coming down to the Capitol today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please go ahead in any order, but remember to identify yourself for the record.
Okay. I'm Carla Benson, and I am personally a survivor of child sex abuse. Childhood should be about smiling, laughing, playing, imagination, innocence, being carefree, and of course, feeling safe. For many children, that's not the case, and unfortunately, I happen to be one of those children. My innocence was taken from me by a stepdad who felt his pleasure was far more important than me being a little girl. At the age of 7, and again at the age of 8, he took what was not his to take, all threatening that he would hurt me again if I ever told anyone. Because it had happened at such an early age, I just assumed that this is what happened in everyone's home, so I didn't tell anyone until I learned in 5th grade that this was not only abnormal, it was wrong. So at age 10, I came out for the first time to my mother and told her what had been happening to me the last several years. Nothing happened. In fact, a few weeks later, I was sexually abused by a family friend while I was spending the night with her daughters. In eighth grade, I tried to speak out again. I had sent or passed a letter in class at the end of seventh grade about what was going on. The teacher took that note, put it in her desk, and it wasn't until eighth grade that I heard about this note again. When I was called to the vice principal's office, I was met there by a police officer who happened to be my sister's best friend's dad and a social worker. I felt like I was in a bit of a quandary as far as the police officer, because I knew that if I spoke up about what was in my letter, my sister risked losing her best friend. This social worker asked me questions using words that were very adult, and I had no idea what they meant, and she asked for details of what had happened to me. And because it had happened so many years before, I didn't remember all the details. Her words, "Carla, if it really happened to you, you must remember," rung through my ears and my being for many, many years, and I paused for a very, very long part of my childhood, wondering if maybe I had just made up everything. I returned to the abusive home again, but again, I was thinking about the words of the social worker, if maybe I just made this whole thing up. It was not until I was 20 years old and away from my abusive environment completely that I was strong enough to stand up to him and come forward, and I had learned that there was a thing called the statute of limitations, and I was still within the statute of limitations. My family was not brave enough to stand with me, and I did not feel strong enough to do this on my own, so I again abandoned this going forward and pressing charges. After many years of counseling and realizing that I was, in fact, strong enough to do this on my own, I was met with the words, "Sorry, the statute of limitations has already passed." I'm sure you can imagine, after all of those years of even being brave enough to come out and admit that it was even happening to me, the fact that I was possibly going to lose any family support and expose my entire family was very scary, and I did not want to hear the words that, "I'm sorry, the statute of limitations is over." No victim of abuse should ever hear these words. It takes a long time to admit it, and like I said, a long time to get brave enough to stand up to your abuser. When my day did finally come, my abuser should have been made accountable for his actions. Instead, he walked away, and I have had to deal with counseling and dealing with what he did to me as a child. Please join the other 33 states who have already taken this statute of limitations away and support the abuser, or excuse me, support the survivors, not the abuser. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Barker, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak today. My name is Carrie Hecox, and I am the medical director of the Children's Advocacy Center of Jackson County, a position I have held for the last 5 years. In my role at the Advocacy Center, my job is to be the examining physician on children who are suspected of having been abused or neglected. And in that role, I have seen well over 1,000 children, roughly 70% of them, who there were concerns that they were victims of sexual abuse. I'd like to talk to you about two things that I think is important for House Bill 3284. The first one, and I will speak both from my personal experience and from what we know from the literature, I think the most important thing to know about child sexual abuse is that it's extremely rare for children to disclose abuse in a short time frame after it happens. Most of the children I see weeks to months to even years after they have been abused. And if we look at the literature, there's been some good adult retrospective studies. This is questioning young adults about if they had been abused as children and if they ever told anyone that they had been abused. In those studies, what we found is 70% of young adults who say that they were abused as children never disclosed that abuse in childhood. So the vast majority of children who are being sexually abused are not disclosing during childhood. And there are several reasons for this. I think it's important to note, like, unlike many other crimes, child sexual abuse is a crime that occurs within families. So children who are being abused are often dependent on their abuser for many different reasons, for financial reasons, food and shelter, and then emotionally dependent. If you look at when child sexual abuse occurs, it's occurring in the developmental period of a child. So I think what was mentioned earlier, children don't necessarily know that it's wrong, or they have some idea that it's wrong, or there's something about this special relationship that makes it okay just this time. So what we have is children who are groomed to believe what is going on is okay, and it takes a very long time for that process to resolve itself for a child to come forward, and indeed many children never come forward to disclose their abuse. I'd also like to talk about something that I see in my own practice regarding intergenerational abuse, which I think has an impact on considerations of the statute of limitations. We know from studies of sexual abuse offenders or pedophiles that it is very rare for you to have a pedophile with a single victim. So it has been my experience where I have seen children who have disclosed sexual abuse by an older family member, say a grandfather, a step-grandfather, and in the process of investigating that, what we find out is that there were suspicions that an aunt had been abused, or that an older family member who had never disclosed during childhood had also been abused. I think resolving the statute of limitations has a lot of impact, not only in holding the perpetrator accountable for what they did to older family members, but also in supporting younger children who are coming forward. If there are more people there to support them, to say, this happened to me too, I support you with what you're doing, that gives a lot of added support to the child, which is very important. The process of criminal prosecution of child sexual abuse cases is frightening for children. It's a very difficult process for them to go through. So having more support is significantly important.
Thank you.
Questions?
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Eric Hasselman. I'm a senior prosecutor with the Lane County District Attorney's Office. I'm in the Major Crimes Division of that office. I've been in that capacity for 10 years, 18 years in my career as a whole. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to the committee this afternoon about House Bill 3284 and the support that I have for this bill. In the last 10 years of my career, the lion's share of my caseload has revolved around the abuse of children, from minor physical abuse cases all the way up to and including aggravated murder. In the middle of that, short of the child's death, there are a lot of other heinous things that happen to children, particularly in the sexual abuse arena, that I've had the good fortune, or the privilege, I should say, to go to bat for these victims in court. House Bill 3284 proposes to eliminate the statute of limitations for sexual abuse, serious sexual abuse of young children, children under the age of 14, with the exception of incest, which is up to 16 years of age, but there's a blood or family relationship. This is an arbitrary limitation, like all statutes of limitation are. It's a bright line that a prior legislature has established, after which a case is dead, an investigation is dead, no possible redress for victims of this type of criminal behavior that can occur. Currently, through my career, I've seen several changes that this legislature has made to the statute that have allowed me to actually prosecute and take action against offenders who in the past I would not have been able to. And I commend the legislature for doing that, because in each and every one of those cases, those have been extremely important to the victims who, again, I've been able to represent their interest in seeking justice in court. Currently, if somebody is able to disclose that abuse up to the age of 29, we can still take action. But if they wait until they're 30, we can't. I would suggest there's no justification for that line. There's no justification for the legislature to establish a limit at that point by which we have to tell 30-year-olds, 31-year-olds, 32-year-olds, 50-year-olds, that I'm sorry, ma'am, I'm sorry, sir, we cannot seek redress. We cannot seek justice for you in the court system against this offender. This type of limitation ignores common sense about sexual abuse in children. And I appreciate the comments of Dr. Hecox and Ms. Benson regarding some of the motivations behind that. Dr. Hecox's references to the literature right now seem to be mirrored by the FBI statistics. The last time I was privy to those statistics, the FBI indicated that it was 1 in 20 that disclose their sexual abuse as children. I don't expect that a change in this legislation is going to significantly change the degree or number of reports that we get. The fact of the matter is this is still very personal to some people. They still have internal motivations never to come forward. But where it can help is in the people that do have the courage through whatever means they've arrived at that to come forward and report their abuse. Late disclosures come up on occasion through my practice. I see it when I'm interviewing prospective jurors. There's times in my career where in picking juries for a child sexual abuse case, I've had somebody in their 50s or 60s indicate that, yes, they themselves were a victim of sexual abuse, and the first person that they'd ever disclosed to was me in that proceeding because the judge had required them to tell the truth. That, I think, captures the reality of this type of crime. It's not like robbery. It's not like theft. It's not like physical assault where people have a motivation to report immediately. There are barriers sometimes, families, that determine that the child should not go forward to the police, and they try to bury it. They try to handle it within the family. We found that that's not effective. This legislature has recognized that over the years. In fact, has made changes even to the expungement statutes, recognizing that there are some crimes, like sexual abuse crimes, that should never go off somebody's record because people who abuse children sexually don't change that behavior. It's only through intervention that we're able to make a difference in that. I understand the opposition to this bill includes the fact that it will be harder for defendants, the accused, to defend themselves. I would remind this committee that that applies equally in our justice system to the state. Even with people coming forward, perhaps people like Ms. Benson, years later telling us about this, we may not be able to prosecute because there's nothing about this bill that changes the burden of proof. The burden of proof still remains with the state to prove these allegations beyond a reasonable doubt. And I will tell you that time is the enemy of prosecutions as well. The memories fading is the enemy of prosecutions as well. It's very difficult for us to proceed on old cases, but not impossible. As I was leaving the courthouse in Lane County this morning, I ran into the detective sergeant from the Lane County Sheriff's Office and told him what I would be doing this afternoon. And he applauded me for my efforts, saying in the last couple years, he's had two investigations he could think of that they were not able to accomplish justice. They were not able to seek justice on behalf of victims on cases that were very strong on their facts. There were witnesses within the family that even the suspect had admitted the behavior to, and they could take no action because of this arbitrary line. That's unacceptable. Oregon finds itself right now in the distinct minority of states that are protecting sexual offenders of children. Another potential criticism for this bill was that, you know, it could resurrect the sins of youth sometime down the line when so many years have gone by, but that's not simply the case. A review of the language of this bill confines it to adult offenders who offended against children. They had to have at least been 18 years old for this statute of limitations extension to apply. And for those who have already passed, those offenders who've already had the good fortune of the current statute of limitations in place, sunsetting their case, their ability to be prosecuted, it can never be resurrected because of the ex post facto protections of this type of criminal procedure. So, as I indicated, the legislature has made strides over the last two decades to continue to increase and recognize this hybrid type of case, the fact that the motivations behind these kind of cases are so much different than other arenas of criminal activity. And it's my respectful suggestion to this committee and the legislature as a whole that it's time that Oregon join the ranks of the majority of states in our country and eliminate a statute of limitations regarding the most serious of child sex offenses.
Thank you, Jenny. Representative Garrett.
Thank you. I think you said this at the beginning, but just remind us what the current statute is, how it works.
Well, it's 12 years from the time that the child reports to either the Department of Human Services or law enforcement. However, if the child never reports, that clock starts ticking when the child turns 18 years of age. And so effectively, they have a victim of or survivor of child sexual abuse or assault has until 30 years of age to report.
30 years or 12 years, whichever is earlier.
Whichever comes first. Right. That's correct. And that, again, the 30-year birthday right now, the offender's scot-free from the ability of the state to prosecute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering why the crimes included stop at 14 and 16 for rape, sodomy, sexual penetration, and sex abuse at 14 and 16 for incest, and why it's not until they're 18 if they're still considered minors.
I can't answer that, not being the sponsor of this bill. However, I would suggest, at least in my practice, that the potential fiscal impact of those prosecutions would be significantly greater than the ones that are proposed.
Thank you.
Thank you. I want to thank especially the victims who showed up today for the terrible hand you've been dealt, and really appreciate you coming down here and being able to stand up and say that. I appreciate, Doctor, that working with these victims is crucial for their survival, and really want to thank you and the prosecution. I know in your business you're paying with your soul to prosecute these cases, to go through them, and I think I speak for the committee and probably most citizens of Oregon. Thank you very much for all you've done and all you're doing.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee.
Christine Rock, Diane Middlens again, and Daryl Fuller. Please identify yourself.
Yes, good afternoon. Chair Barker, thank you for the opportunity to be here today, members of the committee. My name is Christine Rock. I'm from Linn County, a resident of Lebanon. And I'm here today not as a part of any group, but as a grandmother who has watched the multi-generational effects of child abuse and the difficulties that you face when you walk up against that statute of limitations. In my particular case, there was a niece, this is not in the state of Oregon, but in another state, and she just barely reported under the statute of limitations. And it was over 3 years before there was a conviction, and it was only an accidental confession by the abuser that incarcerated that individual for 15 years. But during that process, we discovered that my youngest stepdaughter was his very first victim. She is now nearly 40 years old and still cannot admit to anyone else what has really happened to her. It is become something that is she's internalized. It has made it very difficult for her to parent effectively, and her children now are unfortunately suffering the effects of that initial abuse. The lack of treatment for the victims is costing us so much, and I don't know that anybody's economic model or projection can really quantify that cost. When I look at this bill, the first thing I wanted to do was come up here and tell everybody that was sitting in front of me that if you didn't vote for this, I'd find a way to make sure you were never reelected. That was my gut feel. But then it occurred to me, why is it that we haven't done this before? It just seems so simple to give the victims what they've really needed a long time, because this is a key to healing, to knowing that somebody is going to say, yes, you were abused, and yes, I'm going to do something about it. There are difficulties in prosecution, and nobody's ever going to deny that. it's like putting together a giant puzzle, but the multiple victim factor means that we have to start with the first piece, wherever that comes from, whenever it shows up. And as that first piece shows up, we start adding the rest of those pieces. And in discussing this with district attorneys and other representatives, former law enforcement officers, during the cases I've been involved in, sometimes they aren't always aware of the rest of the victims. And so perhaps, and it's not in this bill, maybe there's a way to come up with some kind of a victim report system that will help law enforcement put together all these various pieces that occur decades apart and great distances apart, maybe even states. It's a bigger problem than we can address here today, by far. But one of the things that caused me to come forward today was to make sure that any yes vote on this measure is followed up by supporting victims in the rest of the changes in criminal statutes and sentencing that are going to follow. It makes no sense to me to open up the statute of limitations for one group of victims only to find out that once we've successfully prosecuted someone else as abused, that their sentence is reduced and they're returned to offend again to find more victims. Those two things seem, in my mind, very, very much in opposition to one another. So I hope that any yes votes that result in favor of this bill are a true commitment to the victims to follow that all the way through and make sure that accountability is solid and that this is not just one place to say yes and then find an excuse to say, well, I just couldn't get there on that other bill. That would be the hardest thing for me to swallow, because no victim should have a hollow victory at the end of this session, thinking they got a victory in one hand and a failure in the other. So please, if you're going to vote yes, make sure that's universally in support of the victims.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Diana Vittelins, and I'm the Crook County District Attorney. I would like to let you know that as far as House Bill 3284 goes, the Oregon District Attorneys Association could not unanimously say in favor or against, and I'm sure you're all shocked knowing that district attorneys that we couldn't agree on something. But when we don't do that, we take no position, yet individual district attorneys are encouraged to come to say either for or against. And I can tell you that the arguments against House Bill 3284 was that it would give a false sense of hope to victims. And I can tell you, prior to thinking about it hard over the weekend, I was inclined to think that this was a way to give false sense of hope to victims. And then when I thought about a victim actually coming forward and disclosing abuse, and then I get to, as an elected official, give a pat answer of, oops, sorry, it's against the statute of limitations is run, is not for me to do. I have a duty to investigate and consider, and if this victim is willing to come forward, then I should have to give a close look at the case. And so that's why, as Crook County District Attorney, I'm fully in support of 3284. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. I've had the privilege of being a part of this process for about 25 years now. And I know from experience it's the responsibility of the proponents of a bill to build the case and build the coalition to convince you to make a change to the existing law. But I'm hoping today to turn that on its head a little bit and ask you to do just the opposite and see if there is a case that can be made, if there's evidence out there or a coalition that can convince you to keep the statute the way it is. Why would we want, and I wasn't around, I don't think, when the statute of limitations was created, I don't know how long ago it was, but why would we want to create a statute to protect people that are sex offenders from prosecution just because they were able to hide it long enough? And if you can make a case for that, you should be a lobbyist, because you have great, great communication skills. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Thank you, panel. Gil Meyer, Becky Strauss.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I was asked to not take a lengthy time in my comments, and so I will truncate them. The statute of limitations is not a mere technicality. it really does underscore and serve and make concrete key foundational principles in our system of justice, which happens to be the best in the world. And those include procedural due process rights, such as a speedy trial, the right to call witnesses, the right to compulsory process, meaning to subpoena evidence and people to the courtroom, the right to present a defense, the very right to the presumption of innocence, and the right to a fair trial itself. There was a comment made that there is no justification for not eliminating the statute of limitations, and I would suggest otherwise. Because with delay, you call into question the ability to serve any of those constitutional principles. Witnesses, and I'm not talking about the accuser, and I'm not talking about the accused. I'm talking about witnesses who might corroborate or who might refute the allegation. They die, they move away, their memory fades, their memory might be influenced by hostility or suggestion or life experience or after occurring events. Similarly, documents which can corroborate or refute an allegation get destroyed, they get mislaid, and they disappear. So with the passage of time, it's inevitable that our trials devolve into one witness against another, which calls into questions the discovery, pretrial discovery rights of the accused in Oregon. And I'm passing out to you, I do have written testimony, I do have a chart that I've submitted online that compares the discovery rights in a criminal case to the discovery rights in a civil case. But what I want to do with this chart is just highlight for the committee how the discovery rights in Oregon are so much less than they are in other neighboring states. So, for one thing, Oregon is the only state in the union that tolerates a 10-2 jury verdict in a criminal case. Louisiana allows 11-1. All other 48 states are unanimous. The federal system is unanimous. The federal territories are unanimous. So in Oregon, you can have two jurors pounding the table saying, I am not convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that the state's made its case. I vote not guilty. And in Oregon, that means something different in Oregon than it does everywhere else in this nation. Because we are the only state that will take that person, put them on a bus, and send them to prison on mandatory minimum Measure 11 sentences with no sentencing discretion. But we are the only state in the union where that would constitute a verdict of guilt. You would like to think, backing up from there, that Oregon would have enhanced discovery rights for the accused, since we do tolerate such reasonable doubt in our jury rooms. And in fact, we do not. So on the left column, you'll see that all the other 13 Western states require that the grand jury get recorded. In almost all those instances, the accused is given copies of those sworn grand jury transcripts, statements. That does not happen in our state. So we have fewer discovery rights on top of a 10-2 jury verdict, and I would submit that because we have a 10-2 jury verdict, it's very, very important that this body and everyone in Oregon pay attention to the procedural due process protections that are present in a criminal case. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Becky Strauss here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. I too have submitted written testimony, and so I'm just going to highlight that and also echo the comments from OCDLA. I just want to at first take a moment to acknowledge that the many people who did come here today in support of this bill, and particularly those who have told their story publicly, I recognize that that takes a lot of courage and really appreciate that. And this bill and these cases present some very compelling arguments, and we certainly respect that. There are some real victims who have suffered some very real harm by these crimes. And why I am here, why the ACLU is here in opposition to the bill, is really to raise the compelling reasons to maintain a statute of limitations. And Gail touched on a lot of those, so I won't go into too much detail, but I think
there's an important protection here for the defendant, and particularly the defendant who is innocent. And those are the interests that we're here to protect. The statute of limitations provides very important safeguards, as I mentioned. And really, it's about being able to present a case before the evidence goes stale. The prosecution, within a few years of the crime, allows the defendant to confront the accuser, allows the defendant to call witnesses, prepare a defense. But as time elapses between the crime and the trial, it does become increasingly difficult to do that in an effective way, if not impossible, for the defendant to prepare a meaningful defense. And that's why we have a statute of limitations and why we think it's important to protect that, even in these instances. So we very much appreciate the intent behind this bill, and certainly acknowledge the highly sensitive nature of the issues and urge you not to move forward with the bill. Thank you.
Great questions. Thank you very much. We're not prepared to move the bill today, and so I'm going to close the public hearing on it. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3184.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3184 requires that all misdemeanors except those listed specifically in the statute be automatically treated as a violation unless the district attorney elects to prosecute them as misdemeanors. Requires that certain misdemeanors be treated as such unless the district attorney elects to treat them as violations. Exempts DUII and misdemeanor elude from violation treatment. Changes arrest authority of federal officers and state law enforcement for those crimes that will be presumptively treated as a violation.
By Beatty, Diana again, and Becky Strauss.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association and as the Cook County District Attorney, Dinah Vitalens, to, I guess, put forward an alternative to House Bill 3184. This bill comes out of the case of State versus Fuller, where a judge in Multnomah County essentially said that even though a district attorney had elected to treat a case as a violation, the defendant was entitled to counsel, jury trial. So it just really avoided all the reasons why a district attorney would want to reduce a case from a misdemeanor to a violation. And so we asked the Oregon Department of Justice Appellate Division to take a look at House Bill 3184, and here's what their recommendation was, and it was Tim Sylvester, and I spoke to him this morning. Essentially, there are two cases that are pending before the Supreme Court, an appeal of Fuller, and then another mandamus action that will essentially answer the question about whether or not the circuit court was correct. And so we're requesting that you wait and take no action on this House Bill 3184. If we win at the Supreme Court, then the problem is solved. If not, we can come back at a later time and work through, because there are some issues with House Bill 3184, and we can work through it and get a solution that really fixes the problem. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Lai Beatty. I'm the manager of the Sex Offender Registry for the state of Oregon with Oregon State Police. On behalf of Oregon State Police, we are neutral on this bill. However, we have a concern or two. The way the bill is written right now, the misdemeanor crimes of sex abuse 3, contributing to the sexual delinquency of a minor, sexual misconduct, sexual assault of an animal, public or private indecency, which are misdemeanors for their first offense, unless even if there's a pre-existing sex crime that would require registration, and then the predatory specific crime of being where children congregate, are all misdemeanors. If a district attorney failed to file that those should remain misdemeanors, they would move to violations. According to the Identification Services Bureau for Criminal Histories of Adults, violations do not appear on criminal histories, so those sex crimes would not appear on a criminal history for anyone in another state, territory, jurisdiction, et cetera, to see. Additionally, failing to register The statute regarding that deals with misdemeanors and felonies. It has no violation language if one would slide through the cracks. That's all I have.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Mr. Chair, could I ask a quick question of Vi Beatty? So, Vi, tell us how many people are currently on the sex offense registry.
We have approximately, if we added in our pending registrations, about 20,000.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3184. And the next bill, 3327, we're going to start at 2:30, so we'll stand in recess until 2:30. call the House Committee on Judiciary back to order. We have House Bill open a public hearing on House Bill 3327. Speaker Kotek and Representative Parker, please.
Good afternoon, colleagues, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. It's a pleasure to be with you today. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm here with Representative Harker on behalf of House Bill 3327. You should have a dash 2 amendment, which is what I'll be speaking to directly. I'm a chief co-sponsor of this bill on behalf of a constituent in my district who prefers to remain anonymous. And given the sensitive nature of the subject, he has some written testimony, which I'm going to read on his behalf because, you know, as members, we occasionally get those stories from constituents that are so compelling that you feel like you need to do something, and I'm here to represent him today more than anything else. At the age of 15, my constituent was charged as an adult with an attempted sex abuse, one Class C felony, based on the victim's inability to consent due to her age, for a non-force incident that did not involve intercourse or jail time. Although they were close in age, the three-year difference became the barrier between a normal life and that of a convicted sex offender for my constituent. He has come to a place where he accepts responsibility for his actions and understands he is accountable. Now, in his 20s, he is unable to find a job, his own housing, or enlist in the armed forces. Despite only receiving probation and completing all court-required programs, he continues to live his life feeling trapped and hopeless, unable to move forward due to this permanent and only mark on his record. This is what my constituent writes about his story. 10 years ago, I was almost 2 months into my high school freshman year when a chain of events changed my entire life, as well as my family and others involved. My mother told me, quote, "I took a wrong turn." When I was 14 and just after I turned 15 years old, I engaged in a sexual encounter with a girl who was 2 and then 3 years younger than me. At the time, I did not understand the consequences of my actions. I remember law enforcement came to my high school to talk to me. I was afraid. I wanted to contact my parents. There was no representation in that room for me, not my parents, an attorney, or even a school official. After a plea as an adult at the age of 15, I was placed on probation for 7 years. At that time, I completed everything the court required of me while going to school. I was required to attend weekly treatment sessions, take regular polygraphics, which I passed, monthly visits to meet with a probation officer home visits, and yearly registration as an offender, which continues today. I never missed a session or an appointment. My family was and still is my rock of support that helped me get through. I know at the time they were hurt and disappointed by the situation, but their support and sacrifice never stopped. My dad decided to retire much too soon, using a portion of his retirement income to retain an attorney for me. He drove me to my sessions every week and occasionally sat in during group sessions when asked. My family didn't go on vacations because I could not leave the state. And I remember my dad and brother took a trip once and my mom stayed behind with me. They both encouraged me to work hard and graduate from high school, which I did. Even though I completed everything and I am no longer on probation, I'm considered unemployable. It's very discouraging to complete job applications only to be turned down, knowing that I could do the job. Every job and apartment I've applied to rejects me after doing a background check. It hurts me because here I am as an adult, now wanting to work, and my parents, who should be enjoying their lives, are still supporting me financially. My mom says, "To get you through this, we do what we have to do," she says. Law enforcement still comes to this house once a year to check. My family does not feel comfortable having social gatherings at the house because of fear that law enforcement will come unannounced. This is not a pity party. All I want is a chance to be independent. I cannot change what happened. I truly have remorse about it. I just want an opportunity to move on with my life. And if I could just comment on this, the amount of what this has done to this young man's life, even though he understands he did make a bad choice, is unimaginable. And it, I don't think, is the point of what he was sentenced with. And the dash 2 amendments are very narrowly written to address his particular situation, and I would guess the situation of others involved. It talks about the person would have to be under 16 years of age at the time of the offense, The person of the differing age would be less than 3 years older than the victim. The victim was at least 12 years of age at the time of the incident. The victim's lack of consent was solely due to incapacity to consent based upon age. The crime was committed in Oregon. The person had no additional sexual offense convictions. It's very narrowly written as the dash two. This is, the difference between a life of hopelessness and a future for this individual. And that's why we have this amendment before you today for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee for hearing this bill. It's very important to me and some of my constituents, and I suspect to each of yours. For the record, I am Chris Harker. I represent House District 34, which is all in Washington County, Beaverton, Cedar Hills area. House Bill 3327 came to me via our former state senator, Suzanne Bonamici, when she left this building. The constituent who I now represent was at that time represented by her. My constituent went out with his girlfriend on the night of his high school graduation. He had just turned 18, and his girlfriend was not yet 15. The constituent was found guilty of a misdemeanor, third-degree sex abuse, and sentenced to 3 years probation, community service, and fines. This constituent has been removed from the sex offender registry list now, but remains constrained by this conviction from that period when applying for jobs or seeking any meaningful employment. His mother, Ann Shettles, is here to speak to the specific impact this conviction has had on his life and his ability to excel. As written, the bill would allow him to expunge the conviction. It requires the offender must have completed all required court-ordered programs or service, and the offender must have already successfully applied to the courts to be taken off the sex offender registry. Only then would an offender be eligible to apply for expungement. The dash two amendments have been described by the speaker, and I would be in support of those amendments should they meet with your approval. Once again, I want to thank you very much for considering this. It's a tricky area, to say the least, and we have people behind us here who will testify to the bill from their particular areas of specialty. Thank you very much.
Question, Mr. Representative Krieger. Speaker Pro Tem, this committee last year had a bill come over 30-0 out of the Senate that dealt with online sexual offense registration. We killed that bill, put a work group together to take a look, because what we are finding out, that, as you stated, even there's ages beyond the 15. What about the guy who's 19, the girl's 17, or some other combination in there? They can't get an education. They can't get in the military. They can't get housing. They can't get a job. And I told Representative Parker, if every man in this building was held to the same standard that some of these crimes are being charged today, we'd all be sex offenders. Last time I told him what I was going to do, remember what I told you? Yeah. I won't say it again, but I think we need to be careful that, I don't want to call it promiscuous, but it's young people learning to be adults, and many men's brains don't engage until 30. They do foolish things. We just got done having, in this committee, where they showed the brain development of people, young people, 30 to 25 before they can make good judgments and not thinking about long-term consequences. We have all that science that tells us they're going to do it because of their brain. Then we turn right around and put a lifetime tag on them that I think in many cases is not justifiable. You only got to have a family member, someone close. And the testimony that we heard last year, or 2 years, I guess 2 years ago, really convinced me that we had done the right thing. We have that work group. There's a bill coming. The DAs want to change it a little bit, and the defense bar wants to change it a little bit. I'd love to have the conversation very quickly this week with you about that bill, because I think we need to pass it and get it down to Ways and Means, because it's a bigger part of this. People on that registry
they've had it. I mean, and we have a way of doing some assessments, risk assessments, to identify the ones that are going to be repeat offenders. And they're doing it in other states. Oregon wouldn't be the first. It's being successfully done in other states. I'd sure hope that you would give us some time to look at that bill the next week and get it moving.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Krueger, I want to thank the committee for the work you have done on the sex offender registry work. I do think it's important. I think we have to look at that bill, and happy to support in any way I can. I also think the more I've learned about the situation of my constituent, there's the registry piece and then the ability to expunge. And when I finally understood what he was asking for, I was, well, can we do that? And I hope we'll consider it, because this is a death sentence for this young man. He has no life. He is completely traumatized, barely leaves his house. That's not what we had in mind. So to the degree that we can take this on, I hope we can.
And a few sessions back, we did change the law with regard, and I believe it was the same person that Representative Parker's talking about, that he at the time was forced to register. And so we changed so he didn't have to register, but this is the next logical step. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate the time.
Thank you once again.
Griffin, Vicki Balu. Okay, so how about Wynn Griffith and Claren or Boston? And Dr. Maletsky?
Representative Barker and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of 3327. My name is Gwen Griffith. I am a law partner at Tonkin Torp and the co-founder of the Cliff Project. At the Cliff Project, we have lawyers all over the state who are donating hundreds and hundreds of hours of time to help young people who were adjudicated as juveniles get off the sex offender registry as they are adults. All of our clients are in their 20s or 30s. They've all been through the excellent Oregon sex offender treatment, best in the country. And now they all want one thing. They want to launch as we would want all of our children to launch. They want a job, they want an apartment, and they want to participate in their own children's school activities. The problem, as you know, is that it is not only relief from registration that is important in giving them these opportunities. Increasingly, employers and landlords and schools don't just ask, "Are you on the registry?" They ask, "Have you ever been adjudicated for any sex crime?" The result is an absence of jobs for these people, as we have just heard, an inability to get an apartment, and being banned from schools where their kids are attending school. I get it. This is risk management by landlords and by schools and by employers. But in fact, the risk is extremely low for many juvenile offenders. Young people are particularly amenable to treatment, and everyone on the registry as juveniles has been through the treatment program. Recidivism, reported by the Oregon Youth Authority, is 4%. In fact, juvenile offending in the sex offense area is transitory in nature. They grow out of it, they successfully complete treatment, and they are no more likely to commit another sex offense than a person in the same cohort who's not on the registry. Back when the expungement statutes were written, I believe it was felt that once a sex offender, always a sex offender. We now have tons of research that shows that juveniles outgrow their sex offending characteristics and can become completely law-abiding citizens. The risk is very low. I'd like the committee to recognize this. We think that 3327 could go further, and we would hope that it would, but it is a good step in the right direction to allow these young people to launch. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon to Chair Baker, the co-vice chairs, and other members of the committee. I am Clarina Boston, Executive Director of Better People, located in Portland, Oregon. For the record, I'd like it to be known that Better People is a nonprofit agency who works with individuals who have legal histories. The program was founded by Oregon State Senator Chip Shields, who was formerly a member of your committee. And Chip and I opened the program in 1998, and we're about to complete our 15th year of service. We provide cognitive behavioral therapy classes using an evidence-based process, moral recognition therapy, to help clients change their thinking as a means of changing their behavior. We also provide a job readiness program using a 23-hour thoroughly researched curriculum to help clients become more efficient and effective in their search for employment. We assist clients in gaining jobs, paying at least $10 an hour with health benefits, and once they're employed, we continue to work with them to make sure they retain employment as part of our retention services. We do not discriminate on the basis of type of crime, as long as a client is at least 18 years old, has 30 days clean and sober, is willing to be responsible for a one-time non-refundable enrollment fee of $35, and is open to making life and lifestyle changes in his or her life. As such, our program is open to those convicted of sexual offenses. I'm here today to testify for changes needed in laws regarding sexual choices made by youth that negatively impact their lives as children and as adults, to also commit on sexual offenses charged against some adults, that is H.R. 3327. From the Justice Policy Institute comes this information. In an effort to pursue dangerous individuals and protect children from sexual violence, legislators have broadly targeted some youth with laws that publicly brands them as sexual predators. This is bad policy because public registers not only fail to protect communities, they hurt young people by stigmatizing them while at the same time alienating them from crime, reducing social networks like families, schools, and jobs because they're not allowed to be around minors. Facts dismiss some of the most common misunderstandings about youth convicted of sexual offenses. Not a fact. Youth commit a large portion of sex offenses. Fact. Less than 1% of all arrests of youth 17 years of age and younger for sex offenses were for sex offenses. Not a fact. Youth convicted of sex offenses will become adults who commit sex offenses. Fact. Research has shown that a young person who commits a sex crime is unlikely to commit another one. There are other statistics that support that we should not be branding all youth involved in childhood sexual situations that requires them to be stigmatized for life by having to register as a sex offender and thereby ostracized because of poorly made, in most cases, uninformed and uneducated choices as a child. My staff and I, over the years, see the extent to what such laws have adversely impacted clients who have no other charges except those dating back to their childhood. Yet they continue to pay a hefty price every day of their lives relative to housing, types of employment, social, political, and professional associations, religious affiliations, and other entities that society deems to be inappropriate as a result of their childhood decisions. One case comes to mind, a 16-year-old man charged with accepted sexual advances towards a 15-year-old girlfriend. They were both willing participants. The parents became involved, charges were made, and the young man was convicted, adjudicated, and incarcerated. The young lady and her parents moved away. But he's still living with this particular decision he made as a young person, and I've heard the statement in here that a lot of young men have made, unfortunately, in their lives. He's very depressed. He's unmotivated. And eventually what happens? We as a society end up having to support this person because they can't get a job. And although this is not perhaps on the table today, I want to share another circumstance having to do with the registration. It's a woman who was victimized as a child in an incest situation. She finally, at the age of 16, ran away from home. And what did she do? Of course, became a prostitute. That's what she knew. As she became rather good at doing this, she attracted other young women who found her to be more convincing than them in getting customers. And so she became a madam. She was finally caught, arrested, charged, and convicted and sent to prison. Having left prison, she finally decided to change her life. She went to college. She got a degree. She finally got a good job because the employers accepted her. But she fell in love, got married, and had children. However, she can't participate with her children as most parents or mothers can in the things that children do because she has to register. And so I would call on you to please give this a lot of thought. This is not justice and probably not the intent of our laws, but there lies the results. We need to change our legal focus and social misunderstandings. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Barker, members of the committee, my name is Barry Maletsky. I'm a physician and psychiatrist. I was a clinical professor of psychiatry at the medical school in Portland for many years and founder and director of the Sexual Abuse Clinic. We've treated approaching now 10,000 sexual offenders in Oregon. Oregon and Minnesota, by the way, have been recognized nationally for being leaders, both in jurisprudence and treatment of sexual offenders. It's important to distinguish between two types of offenders. There are probably within those groups subdivisions, but for the purposes of understanding legislation, it's very important to understand the difference between a situational offender and a predatory offender. Predatory offenders can be treated. Many who go through treatment will not offend again, but they're more difficult to treat, they're more likely to reoffend. We can distinguish them fairly easily based on history and based on a variety of assessment instruments. You've already heard all of the reasons about juveniles and adults needing to be covered by this legislation. I just want to add, from my perspective as a physician, the science behind it. The vast majority of kids who are convicted of sexual offenses will not go on to become offenders themselves as adults. In our series of over 7,000 offenders, we isolated the juveniles and found that about 4% went on to commit some type of sexual offense as an adult, which means 96% did not. Situational offenders are those who would not have offended had they not been in that particular situation, and that includes most juveniles. And actually, the majority of adults that we brand as sexual offenders are situational offenders who, if they were not put in that situation again, would not reoffend. They do deserve treatment, and we have excellent treatments for that group. Approximately 90 to 95% of them will never reoffend again. I think we need to appreciate that distinction between the predatory offender and the situational offender. I also think we need to distinguish between opinion and science. And I can only state that from a scientific point of view, we know how to treat sexual offenders, and the vast majority, particularly of situational offenders, will not reoffend. This is not a small problem. Those of us who treat offenders and every day recognize that I can, in looking through briefly our statistics, 50 or so cases have come up within the past several years of people who either as juveniles or sexual situational offenders carry with them the stigma for the rest of their lives and have been unable to obtain what we would consider to be normal attainments of adults in our society. So I won't go on and on down, because I think you all have a general recognition of the distinction between situational and predatory offenders and the need for the legislation, a need for legislation to take that distinction into account. We can assess the distinction and we can measure and pretty well predict the difference between a predatory and a situational offender and predict whether they're going to be at high or low risk for reoffense. And the folks that are covered under this bill, and I agree it doesn't go far enough, but it's a good step, because the people covered by this bill who are eligible to get off of the registry and eligible for expunction are those who really are low-risk offenders and probably do not deserve to be castigated for the rest of their lives. That's all I had. Thank you.
Any questions? As you can see, we're close to the kind of the witching hour for us, and so some of our members have had to leave. We're going to try to continue this, though, to get through the hearing today. I called Griffin. Mark McKechnie. Vicki Ballou and Ann Settles. Yeah. People are not leaving because they're not interested in anything. They really have their obligations. Thank you. Please go ahead.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Mark McKechnie. I'm the Executive Director of Youth Rights and Justice. I will be very brief. Youth Rights and Justice supports HB 3327 with the dash two amendments. My written testimony reflects dash one, and it was written earlier this morning before the dash two amendments became available, but the amendments are essentially the same, with one added restriction that the conviction that's expungible requires only one victim was involved. I don't want to go into a lot of detail, but I think a lot of good points have been made that the offenses for which expungement would become available under this bill are lower level offenses that really reflect normal or near normal adolescent sexual behavior, and far more teenagers and adolescents are engaging in this behavior, to Representative Krieger's point, than those who are ever caught, arrested, or prosecuted. So it is just the very unlucky few who are caught in this web and suffer the lifelong consequences. As a previous witness said, this bill doesn't go far enough, but it's a good start, and we encourage you to pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Barker, members of the committee, my name is Vicki Ballou. I'm also a lawyer at Tonkin Torp with Gwen and a participant in the CLIF project, which stands for Changing Lives Forever. I support House Bill 3327, as the others have said, because it's a step in the right direction. But to me, the flaw is that it's focusing on the Romeo and Juliet situation, the older offenders, but it ignores a huge population of kids who are much younger. Both the victim and the offender are younger, where there may be touching or other sexual contact. Let me tell you a quick story about one of the clients we had in CLIF. The name has been changed. Jeremy's mom was a drug and alcoholic abuser. He pretty much raised himself from the age of two on, very little adult supervision. As you can imagine, he was angry. He was the wild child in the apartment complex. When he was 12 years old, he and two sisters got together, and he touched their private parts with his hand. There was no sexual intercourse, but because of the fact that he was so destructive and so disrespectful in the apartment complex, once this became known, all the adults, the other families wanted him out of the complex. As a result, he went through treatment, and as the others have said, I think the treatment saved his life. reading his file, everyone said he had an anger problem, not a sex problem. He was released from registration and has gone on. He now holds two jobs. Fortunately, he has not been barred from employment because he still has the offense on the record. I would urge you to adopt this, but to also this House Bill 3327, but also to think about simplifying it. When you think about it, if the offense was committed by someone under 16 or under 12 or under 10, and the victim was younger, and if an Oregon judge has determined that they have been rehabilitated, they've completed treatment, they've been rehabilitated, and they're unlikely to offend again, and with the 4% figure showing that there is a very, very low recidivism rate, I would ask you to consider expanding this so that under those circumstances, these young people, both men and women, we have both men and women clients, that they have a chance for a life going forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, my son and I testified before the House and Senate Judiciary Committees in 2007 regarding what was then House Bill 2333, which eliminated the requirement to register for those who met certain limited conditions. The bill was later passed and signed by Governor Kulongowski. Matt has since petitioned the court and was granted relief from registering. Also, my son couldn't be here today, and part of what she passed out was his written testimony about how this affects his life. At that time, we thought it would enable him to move forward with his life, but has since realized, while it relieved the burden of registering, it still did not allow the relief needed. We're asking for your help again regarding those who meet these certain limited conditions, not only for Matt, but for other young men in his situation. A lot of this has been said. They're not violent predators. They're young people who exhibited poor judgment. It's poor judgment exhibited by many young people. However, only a small portion of these are arrested and charged. Because sex crimes are not eligible for expungement, this small group pays a lifetime for their poor judgment, which is exhibited by so many of their peers who don't have to pay the price. As the law currently stands, we're punishing these young people for a lifetime. They have a difficult time securing employment, and if they marry and have families, their income level is usually at a poverty level because of employment constraints. The costs of poverty are large to the state and society. Even Goodwill, one of the employers of last resort, will not hire these young people because they have been convicted of a sex crime. When my husband spoke with the manager at one of our local stores, he said, "We don't care what the circumstances may be. They're sex offenders, registering or not." My son has worked very hard to move his life forward. He recently completed his degree in web design at Portland Community College. He completed an internship with a national nonprofit and now works there as a web designer. He got his job because he was able to prove himself, but we don't know what would happen if he lost that job or if he would be able to find another because he could not prove himself.
Excuse me, ma'am, could you identify yourself just for the record?
Oh, my name is Ann Shuttles.
Thank you.
And I'm the mother of Matthew Shuttles. Another problem, Matt is also getting married in August to a beautiful young lady who totally understands the difficulties that they will face. The problem comes right now that they cannot find an apartment in the Portland area. Most apartment complexes in the Portland area are owned or managed by corporations that have a policy to never allow anyone who has a sex offense to rent in their complex. They do a background check. He and his fiance lived with us for 10 months until she could get an apartment in her name. The apartment complex does not know he lives there. They just believe he is her boyfriend who comes to visit a lot. Most, if not all, misdemeanors are expungible in Oregon. Passing a law such as this would benefit the state of Oregon by allowing these young people to have a future with more possibilities and with little or no risk to the state or society. They can go to college and obtain jobs that will allow them to be taxpayers and not be a drain on society. They stand a much better chance of not being reliant on government resources to help support them and themselves and their family. It's easier for them to find an apartment, giving them more stability. Please give them a chance to contribute and move forward in their lives. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, panel. Tom Gillis, looks like Lane County, Diana again, and Bi Beatty again, please. Please go ahead and just start, give your name for the record and kick it off so we can hear.
My name is Tom Gillis, and I would also like to state for the record that I am a sex offender. I was convicted in the state of Idaho for a felony conviction of injury to a child. Upon moving to the state of Oregon, I was informed that due to the nature of my crime, I needed to register. I tell you this not as part of a victim role, but just to give you some of my perspective. I have successfully completed a sex offender treatment program, and I can tell you that that was the best thing that ever happened to me. I was convicted as an adult at the age of 22. Now at the age of 27, I feel like I have turned my life around. I have changed the things that I needed to change. I'd also like to state that I do also support the previous House bill, I believe it was 3284, that removes the statute of limitations for crimes of a sexual nature. I know a lot of gentlemen that have gone through a program much like mine, much like others that have spoken before me, that deal with the cognitive behavioral therapy and changing how you think and changing the way that behavior transforms your life. I'd like to say that the label of sex offender, and I feel like it's been stated well here prior. It's hard to get a job. It's hard to get housing. It's hard to get social acceptance. I know gentlemen who would rather say that they had, a manslaughter charge, or that they were convicted of selling heroin, rather than say that they had a sexual offense. There are lots of statistics, lots of research done to show that with the negative stereotype that comes with sexual offense, as opposed just to employment and housing, a lot of our sexual offenders are becoming homeless and therefore less easy to track. I believe that with the ability to expunge our sexual offenses, that it does not become part of our record, and are easier to get jobs. It's easier to maintain employment. It's easier to maintain a place to live and become productive, successful members of our society and be able to raise our families in safe and welcoming environments. I do believe, also want to take a moment and say that I support House Bill 2549 as it attains to the risk assessment of sexual offenses in the state of Oregon. And I believe that with House Bill 2549, as it obtains to House Bill 3327, is going to be a very positive effect in not only our state government, but also as it reflects in our national government. And the success rate, I mean, you look at some of the stats, and even among adult offenders, the recidivism rate in the state of Washington, at least, is only 2.4%. That's huge. That's less than the 4% from youth to adult offending. We all enjoy a good story of change. Our movies and our stories are filled with it. I think of Jean Valjean and Les Miserables. I think of Edward Norton's character in American History X, and even as far as to say Darth Vader in the Star Wars series. They all have that, I was a bad person, I went through change, and I've come out great on the other side. And I feel like this bill really gives the sex offender population in Oregon hope that they can be that hero in not only our families' lives, but the lives of others around them. I will be open to any questions you may have. I recognize my unique position and view on this in this room, and I welcome any questions you may have.
Thank you for coming and giving your testimony. Bye. Mm-hmm.
Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lai Beatty. I'm the manager of the Oregon State Sex Offender Registry, employed by Oregon State Police. We are neutral on this bill. However, just to kind of give an overview and clarification, the crimes that are under consideration are rape 3, sodomy 3, sex abuse 3, contributing to the sexual delinquency of a minor, and sexual misconduct. Those are the crimes covered under certain circumstances relief. To further clarify, I work with the military quite often in cases where youth have been adjudicated for sex crimes in juvenile court, and as long as a youth is not having to register, the military will accept them. I also work on a daily basis with housing authorities around the state, and they tell me that based on federal law, a person who is required to register cannot receive federal subsistence for housing assistance, but once they're not having to register, they can get that assistance. We also have juvenile courts all over the state who are doing set-aside vacates. There's a growing number that we're seeing at the registry where the juvenile record is basically vacated and sealed. It's not removed totally, but we treat it like it did not happen. In the adult world, there's been a lot of talk about the risk assessments under House Bill 2549. Keep in mind that to do those risk assessments, the previous sex crimes that a person committed as an adult have to be available for review. Otherwise, the risk assessment tool does not work appropriately. Additionally, for certain circumstances, you're talking a victim of 14 to 17 years of age and a defendant of less than 5 years older, so it would be 18 to 22 years of age. Having said all that, I did some quick number crunching. We currently have about 160 persons who had adult crimes that the registration was removed under certain circumstances relief since January 1st of 2008. Of those, about 14 to 16 have reoffended within 3 to 6 months with a new victim. The other issue with removing the previous offense is then the court does not know in a new offense if it's a single victim or if it's a multiple victim. In the juvenile world, we have a minimal number of persons with juvenile adjudications where they have received relief under certain circumstances. So the numbers really aren't there. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Quick question. I'm sorry. Vi, what numbers did you just say? You said 14 to 16. I just want to write that down.
14 to 16 persons who were convicted as adults that were relieved under certain circumstances have reoffended within 3 to 6 months with a new victim.
Out of how many?
160.
Thank you.
Any Chair, yes. Sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Chair Barker, members of the committee, Dinah Vitalens here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I'm the Crook County District Attorney, and I'd like to put on the record that we oppose House Bill 3327. We believe that the current expungement statutes, which prohibits child abuse and sex offenses from being expunged, should continue to be the policy. And I also wanted to let you know that a child under the age of 12 in Oregon cannot be charged with the crime. That's all I have.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we will carry this over to April 11th.